Thanks very much. And look, I would just like to welcome you all here today to the State of the Nation Conference. Let me introduce myself first, David Byers, Chief Executive of CEDA. And look, I think we've got a great program lined up. Just by way of one preliminary comment, we are waiting for advice from Lindsay Tanner that he'll be here. Probably he's going to be here about 5 or so minutes late. So we're going to sort of start things off and then we'll take it from there. But I was thinking that, you know, as you all know, this is the 30th time, the 30th State of the Nation, staged by CEDA. And if you think about that just for a moment, the first conference was in 1980, and it was at a time when Malcolm Fraser was Prime Minister and Australia's population was only 14.5 million people. And many things have obviously changed since that time. Think of all the economic and the social shifts which have occurred through the 1980s, the 90s and into the early 2000s. And this conference has been something of a standby through that period as a gauge of the status of the state of the nation. And I think this conference will be no different. We've got multiple challenges confronting us as a country. The global economic conditions, some of which we heard about this morning, energy and climate change issues, how we build and finance infrastructure, and even the difficulty of overall policy setting under the current economic conditions. And all those matters are going to feature on our agenda as we roll through the balance of the conference. I'd also like to acknowledge our conference co-sponsors, CPA Australia and Shell. We're very, very pleased with your support, and we do appreciate that. We can't really stage conferences like this unless we do get support out of our membership base, and we very much appreciate that. Just a couple of notes on logistics for the conference. We have, of course, invited the media to be present, and so they'll be here during the course of the conference. Mobile phones, if you could just make sure that they're turned off or turned to silent in consideration of all of the speakers. We will have audio and the presentation material available on CEDA's website after the conference, and we'll forward that to you via email when it becomes available. Also, in your conference packs, you've got some feedback forms, so we'd very much appreciate people completing those at the end of the conference, and we'd really love to get some great feedback. Honest feedback, I guess. So I guess just to start things off, you know, I'd like to welcome everyone to the State of the Nation once again. From CEDA's perspective, we have conferences like this not just to fill halls, but we do so because there's a purpose in mind when we actually do that. And for this conference in particular, what we want to do is to make sure that people leave better informed than when they arrived, that people take the opportunity to engage in an active dialogue with our senior political leaders and senior business figures. And there'll be multiple opportunities through this morning's conference, but also through the balance of the day, for people to be able to take advantage of that. But finally, I think it's important for people to take the opportunity to test your own ideas, whether it be in the formal sessions or the informal sessions. I'm sure we won't agree on every issue, but I think it's also true to say that every person sitting in this room is trying to make this country a better place, and that should be the starting point of every debate that we do have over the next day and a half on the state of the nation. I thought while we're waiting for the Finance Minister to arrive, I'd just take a moment to describe one of the things that CEDA has got on the go at the moment, which is a latest research report. And we do have a report coming up on climate change, which, as you know, features quite strongly within the program. The report we have is an important one. It's the second one we've done. We did one back in 2007, and the environment has changed a little bit since then. But the focus of this one is really to look at the international agreement making process coming up to Copenhagen. And we've taken some authors from many different countries to describe their perspectives on what they think is going to come out of Copenhagen. And we have, of course, Australia featured in there, but also perspectives from Germany, from the US, from China, and from India. And one of the things which really does come through that report from the papers that I've seen, and I mentioned it will be published next month, is that the whole basis for in which we set international agreement makings agreements in this area is really coming under question. That is the basis of trying to establish quantitative emission targets and be able to achieve those by a certain period of time against a certain timetable. And many of the authors make the point that that's going to be a very, very difficult process to continue when it actually gets to the nitty-gritty in Copenhagen. Increasingly, what is coming through, at least the research report, is that price is really going to be the mechanism through which big changes are brought about. And the authors really settle on the proposition that there's going to be a lot more focus on price-based approaches rather than a focus on trying to reduce emissions by a certain period of time. And as a specific application of that price-based approach, we've taken a specific look at a number of papers on the vexed question of an emissions trading scheme versus a carbon tax, and come out really with some very fairly, I think, strongly felt views that from some of the authors that when you really analyse both of those alternatives of actually establishing a price signal through the economy, that a carbon tax would be a lot more transparent, it would be simpler, wider in application, and something which it might not be popular now and it might not be sort of in keeping with the mainstream, but it certainly has a lot to commend it. The second thing I thought that we would do while we're waiting for Lindsay Tanner is I would just like to invite Dr. Michael Porter, who's our research director, to the stage. And I think Michael will talk about a couple of other key areas that we have underway. The first one is probably on the broadband issue, and the second one that Mike will talk about is water, some work we have underway on water. Michael.
Well, I think Lindsay Tanner is very interested, I think, in the structure of infrastructure projects, ladies and gentlemen. So I think we just might say a few words about what you can get off our website on broadband. The government is talking about spending $40 billion, but our stock take of what's going on in broadband, what's under the ground and what's in the air, suggests that, as the Treasurer indicated a little while ago, they ought to think first about the regulatory environment and indeed the competitive structure, because we've got cable going past 3 million homes, and that cable is capable, as Sol Trujillo revealed after he was cut out of the tender, that cable is capable of delivering broadband at about 300 times the speed most of you are getting it at the moment. Incredibly fast thing using a system called DOCSIS 3, which Trujillo also talked about. So there's an option on cable that is part of why there's nervousness about investing in fibre. Secondly, the bandwidth that's being released by the closure of analog television, if it's auctioned off to the mobile companies, they may be willing, I've seen reports indicating, they may be willing to spend $10-15 billion for the bandwidth that would make mobile phones capable of receiving digital images, television and so forth very efficiently. And that would reach 99% of the population. Thirdly, on the copper that goes into your home, the CEDA stock take on these issues finds that VDSL, which people in Canberra know a bit about, we're capable of having on copper very fast connectivity. And as a result, there's competition issues which are profound that may suggest you don't really need to spend $40 billion. In fact, we could raise money. So this might be a very good question for our Finance Minister, the Treasurer, and Minister Conroy. How should we really become a well-connected society in broadband? Do we really need to spend $40 billion? That's the question CEDA is looking at. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Mike. Well, look, the fog is now lifted.
We've entered into a new era in public finance in Australia over the past year or so, and the entire community, governments most particularly, but the community generally, are in the process of adapting to that new era. Now, I say new advisedly because, in truth, what's happening is we are going back to normality after a period of the bulk of a decade of extraordinary fiscal circumstances in Australia, where you've had governments, both state and federal, awash with money and able to basically behave quite generously to the people who vote them in and run surplus budgets and avoid, in most cases, tough decisions, major savings initiatives. Now, that is a highly unusual set of circumstances that Australia has rarely seen before, and it's very clearly come to an end, and we're seeing state budgets around the country underline this point literally almost as I speak and over the past few weeks. So we are moving back to the circumstances that Australians are much more used to, and that means a big process of adjustment. And if you want to illustrate this, and apologies for the slight partisan tone in this observation, the four federal budgets, 2004, 5, 6 and 7, collectively had virtually no major savings initiatives in them at all. Virtually none. A handful of modest things here and there, the odd tweaking, but in overall terms, virtually none. We put in place very substantial savings initiatives in the budget last year. We were criticised by some for not doing more, but they did total up to $33 odd billion over 4 years. And, of course, we've done similar savings initiatives in the current budget. And you're starting to see the same logic flow through at the state level as well. So, in a sense, what it means is the gravy train is very much over for politics in this country, and we are now entering a new era of very tough, challenging fiscal management where the cost of failure will be very high indeed. That really does lift the onus enormously for treasurers and finance ministers around the country. It is crucial for the long-term prosperity of Australia that we succeed in the challenges that we're being presented with. The budget that we have just put down for the forthcoming financial year, of course, does contain some very significant savings measures, particularly savings measures that are destined to really deliver significant dollars in the medium term. In many cases, the changes to indexation arrangements or the change to the pension age, things of this kind, will actually take quite some time to deliver the savings that are projected. The reforms of the private health insurance rebate are in the same category. But it's crucial that we fix the structure of the budget in the medium term, and these are the kind of initiatives that are required. Perhaps less spectacularly and less visibly, there are also many initiatives that are designed to improve the efficiency of government, to reduce the proportion of total public spend that is on our own functioning, our own operations. This is an ongoing process that I'm responsible for and that has been largely a process of chipping away, of enacting often quite modest reforms, but many of them, across the length and breadth of the federal public sector. Some of these have been fairly high profile, for example, the Gershon reforms to information technology purchasing, which will deliver very substantial savings, hundreds of millions of dollars over the period of the forward estimates, and in the longer term, very significant savings with respect to the reform of how we undertake data centre management. But there are many, many other reforms that have been undertaken which collectively are contributing about $1 billion a year, or $5 billion over 5 years of savings to the Commonwealth. All of this money that's becoming increasingly important to ensure that we have got a sustainable fiscal position. So just small examples that are in this year's budget. We have had a situation where the family relationship centres, the government's program for delivering advice and assistance to couples who are potentially breaking up or are breaking up, and a range of other services, were actually involved in negotiating contracts and managing contracts with two separate federal government agencies, Attorney General's and FACSIA, Families and Community Services, pretty much doing the same thing, the same processes, the same involvements. We've rationalised that so that we're just going to have one government agency that will actually be contracting with the family relationship centres. Similarly, we are rationalising grant programs. We've had a substantial rationalisation of programs with respect to climate change initiatives. The Wilkins Review, which I established last year, has reported and led to a significant rationalisation of what was over 60 different programs purportedly dealing with climate change and reduction of carbon emissions, grant programs. And a similar logic has been taken to the apprenticeship programs that the government currently has in place, where we have rationalised those into a single tools for the trade set of initiatives. So there's been a wide range of these things put in place both in last year's budget and in this year's budget just to try and get better value for money and to change the ratio between what we spend on our own operations relative to the total spending of government so that a higher proportion of total spending actually directly benefits people, benefits the community, rather than actually being just the cost of the government existing and operating. And finally, in a related but separate area, that is something that I spoke about at this gathering last year and is something that is gradually unfolding, is the Operation Sunlight reforms. It's essentially about transparency of government financial information, budget information, and although it's something that will rarely attract newspaper headlines, it's a very important part of accountability and efficiency, because inefficiency does flourish with inadequate information, with opaque information, and under the arrangements that we inherited, it was almost impossible to get serious, decent information in detail about the federal budget and where money was going, what it was being spent on, and what the projections were for the future. Now, it's quite a complex thing reforming this because, of course, you've got established entrenched systems in place. It is a vast beast that you can't just turn on its head overnight. And so we've had a staged implementation of a variety of major programs to improve the quality and accessibility of financial information. And the two key things that have been introduced in this year's budget as part of that program have been, first, a major reform of outcome statements. For those who are not aficionados of the budget papers, the structure that was introduced by the Howard government about 10 years ago, with our support, involved structuring the budget around the concept of big picture outcome statements against which expenditure is purportedly judged, and then details of outputs, which is in effect the money that's being spent and the measurement of the amounts being spent in furtherance of those outcomes. The problem with this system was that although it's conceptually good, the outcome statements, particularly early on, in some cases were ludicrous. For example, initially the outcome statement for defence spending was the defence of Australia and prevention of threat to Australia, and that was it. That was kind of the entire outcome statement for the defence budget, so in other words, a statement of the bleeding obvious, which didn't take you any further. So we've enacted a range of reforms in consultation with individual departments to outcome statements, so they now at least provide a greater degree of specificity and precision about exactly why we're spending money, what it's supposed to achieve. But this is only an initial stage in a longer term process, which I hope and believe will lead to metrics being established which enable us and the general public to assess government spending against indicators that are measures of success or failure, measures of progress in major areas of government spending. Now, there are departments like education and health that are making significant progress in this regard, so that, for example, if you look at the Close the Gap Indigenous health initiatives, there is a set of detail being developed there which is designed to be a measuring stick for government spending in initiatives that are designed to close the gap between Indigenous health outcomes and non-Indigenous health outcomes in Australia. And we will have objective metrics there against which the impact of government initiatives can be measured in the longer term. This won't be entirely appropriate in every conceivable area of government spending, but will be a very useful discipline in many areas of government spending. So we've made a significant step down the path to that kind of world in this year's budget with stronger, more detailed and more meaningful outcome statements. Finally, in this regard, and very much in the same vein, we have reinstituted serious detail on program by program spending, both for the forthcoming year and in the forward estimates, something that the Howard government effectively stripped out of budget papers in its changes about 10 years ago. And for any of you who've ever had the delightful experience of reading the yellow books, the portfolio budget statements, which are the detailed statements of individual departments, and realising just how completely meaningless they have been in recent years, this is a major step forward. Now, it's early days yet. We've got the first instalment in place in this year's budget. There'll be more fine-tuning, more work on putting the detail back into the public domain so that people can examine where individual programs are heading, how much is being projected to be spent, all of those kinds of things. These are reforms that are very important to discipline on government spending, discipline in the way we manage the government finances, and ultimately very important to that wider task that I alerted to in opening, which is that the days of Father Christmas budgeting are gone, and it is unlikely they're coming back in the foreseeable future. And the days when governments could have budgets with virtually no savings measures, no tough decisions, the days when governments could endlessly hand out government grants and entitlements as a way of winning additional electoral support with no wider consequences to the budget, those days are gone. And I don't believe they're coming back. That means that we've got a very different fiscal environment, very different political environment. The Rudd government has hit the ground running, adapting to those changes, leading the community in back to where budgets and fiscal policy always should be, and that is making tough priority decisions, investing for the long-term future of Australia, and ensuring that we have a sustainable fiscal position into the medium and longer term. Thank you very much. I'm very happy to answer questions between now and about 5 minutes' time. Thank you.
Gillian Franklin, the director of CEDA. We had the opportunity this morning to hear the Treasurer speak and give us his view. And one of the comments he made, I'm just interested in your perspective, he said that our deficit, he described it as modest. And I'm interested in your view, whether you see it as modest.
I think in international terms, in the current circumstances, he's right. When you look at major countries, the countries that we typically compare ourselves with and, in a sense, our society is to a degree influenced by or derived from, the UK and the US, our budget deficit that's projected is decidedly modest. Theirs are in double figures. And I can tell you one thing, that whatever challenges we have been facing over the past 6 or 9 months in this country, most mornings I wake up very grateful for the fact I'm a minister in the Australian government and not a minister in certain other governments around the world. So we are in very challenging fiscal circumstances, there's no doubt about that, caused by an unprecedented slump in economic activity around the world. But in compared with the, for example, the G8 countries, or let's say G7, there is only one country in that list that's got a budget deficit smaller than Australia's, and that's Canada, and it's only slightly smaller.
Yes, good morning, Minister. David Stewart-White from Parsons Brinckerhoff. You talked about the efficiency and saving measures that your government's putting in place, and we congratulate you for that, but what's your view about state governments and the relationship between federal and state governments and the efficiencies that could be driven there?
I'll be cautious in my observations, but I think you are just seeing the early stages of state governments starting to adapt to the new reality as well. And this is particularly challenging for some of them because of the fact that the global financial crisis and its wash-up with the global recession have just hit at a time when they have ramped up infrastructure investment, an investment that I think is extremely important for the longer term. So that's forced them into some very challenging choices. And I think you will see that the emphasis is going to increase within the states of similar themes of extracting more from their own operations, the efficiency with which they run themselves, and also inevitably some of the things they spend money on are going to come into question. They will have to make tough choices as well. We've seen some early indicators of this with some of the state budgets, but I think just as with the federal government, they're going to face some pretty challenging decisions. And although their balance sheets are in pretty good shape generally, they, just as with the federal government, you can't afford to keep paying yourself more than you earn indefinitely. And so they will face some pretty challenging decisions over the next few years, inevitably, irrespective of which party's in government.
Minister Michelle Narricot from CPA Australia. Minister, we heard a number of initiatives that are being put in place by your government to really reduce the cost of service delivery from the government bureaucracy perspective. One thing I'd really value your vision on, and that is the future role of the not-for-profit sector in partnering with government in reducing the cost of service delivery.
We have, as part of my other responsibility, which is Minister for Deregulation and co-chairing with Craig Emerson, the Business Regulation and Competition Working Group of COAG, one of the initiatives that's kicked off recently there is a process of reform in cooperation with the states of red tape and regulation applying to the not-for-profit sector. And the initial focus is predominantly on things like fundraising rules, which vary enormously from state to state and make it very difficult to run national fundraising efforts. Charters of accounts, there's a variety of key themes. But one of the issues that's inevitably going to emerge, I think, in that process is the interface between the not-for-profit sector and government. What we've seen in recent decades, of course, is in effect the outsourcing of a lot of activities that traditionally were, if they happened, done by government directly. And by and large, that outsourcing has been successful, in my view, but it's got its issues. It's got some challenging questions. One of the great problems that I'm keen to pursue is the processes of accountability and managing that relationship, which in themselves become quite costly both for government and for the NGOs. Now, we've got to have accountability processes. We've got to have scrutiny of how money is spent to ensure it's not wasted or misappropriated or misused. But getting those processes right so that we minimise the burden on individual organisations is a big challenge. And there are instances I've encountered where you've got organisations that are managing as many as 60 different government grant programs. Now, you can imagine what the running of those organisations is like. So there are some challenges there for us to do this a lot better. But I would say that I think the transition to having not-for-profit organisations do these things on behalf of government rather than being directly delivered by public servants has broadly been successful and positive, but it does raise a number of complicated issues, and efficiency of service delivery and cost is clearly one of them. When you've got that kind of purchaser-provider type split, there's a lot of complex issues there. I am keen to pursue them.